Hello and welcome along to the Daytimes podcast with me, Danny Parkinson. And, well, it's been a fantastic first week. We've had some great guests on, we've had some fantastic fans on. And if you missed any of it, if you want to hear the full lots, we've put it all audioboom.com/Radio Yorkshire. Make sure get yourself involved with that one. And, well, it feels only right to be starting with one of the bigger guests we had on this week. We only went and got Brian Carney, the rugby league legend and expert that he is. He joined us earlier on to preview the Challenge Cup, and he had some very interesting things to say.
My pleasure.
I mean, it's a massive weekend of action coming up. Warrington against Hull FC. In terms of the overall season, this has become a really hard one to call, hasn't it?
I can't split them. Really, I look at the two sides, and you can make a case, a very strong case for both sides. And putting aside the fact that Hull have beaten twice this year, just looking at this game and how the teams are going into the game, I can't split them. I know Warrington are made the slightest of favourites by the bookies, 2 points or so, but I can't separate them.
No, neither can I when I look at these two teams. And Warrington, of course, have made a habit of winning this a few years ago, but it has been 4 years since they've managed to get the hands on it now. I imagine they'll be hungry to get the hands on some silverware again.
Well, that's the other beauty about this is you got two sides that are desperate for a bit of silverware for slightly different reasons. I think Hull will look back at their history in the last 20, 25 years and say, well, we haven't got enough trophies for a club of our stature and for the resources we put into the team. The fans will look at it and say, well, look, we're well short a bit of silverware. Warrington, now, while they've had some silverware recently, probably not enough for the investments they've made in their team. So, a bit of pressure on both sides to deliver silverware. Not quite like a Leeds going in, you know, maybe, or a Wigan going in, where they've had some silverware in very recent years. But I think these two sides definitely have pressure on them.
I was going to say, do you think that's good for the game as well? The fact that last year it was Leeds against Hull KR and Leeds ended up winning it by a canter in the end. The fact that no one could call it and either team can win it over 80 minutes, it surely must be good for the Cup.
Of course it is. Look, you're getting two clubs that are going to have big following down there. I'll say this about Hull FC. Whether it's the Challenge Cup or Super League, my preference in the next few years would be Super League. I'd like to see Hull FC win a grand final. I think the game as a whole needs it. And I think I'd like to see Hull and some Rovers have some success. I don't think our game benefits so much with a Leeds or maybe even a Warrington or a Wigan or a St. Helens win. Our game benefits far more with a team like Hull FC or a team like Hull Dixon Rovers winning a major trophy, you know, and sort of cementing the followings that they have and then increasing even those followings. So I think that's what I'd like to see happen soon. And I think a grand final win for Hull FC would be a huge boost to the game.
Fantastic to see Hull FC do it over a number of years as well, I suppose, because you saw that breaking up the top four after Bradford sort of fell away. Huddersfield looked like they might be that team to do it, but the idea of Hull FC managing to break it all up a little bit and maybe even having to go to the grand final this year as well, it just went much better for the game overall.
Of course it is, but listen, it's no good unless you get a trophy. It's no good, and there's no better evidence of that than Huddersfield, who now find themselves, you know, scratching around in the qualifiers. You got to get a trophy out of it.
And just looking at Super League as a whole, do you think that's become just more competitive over the last couple of years anyway, the introduction of the formats? Do you think that's been good for the game?
I think it's probably become a little bit more competitive, but you've got to ask the reasons as to why it's become competitive. Is it because the standards increased across the board and all teams are getting better and investing more and getting better players? Or has the standard dropped a little bit and it's getting more competitive because the top is closer to the sides that haven't been competitive. So I'm not sure of those reasons, of the exact reasons. But definitely need to be on board quickly.
Yeah, it certainly looks that way as well. And Brian, I have to ask as well, looking at the Challenge Cup, as a player, you know, what's it like, going down to Wembley and seeing everything that's there? What is that kind of experience like as a player?
Well, I have to say to you, Danny, I was lucky enough to win the Challenge Cup, but unfortunately it was when I was on the road. So we were up in Murrayfield.
Ah, yeah.
And I'll tell you this, despite the fact that I've had a win as a Challenge Cup, it's somewhat diminished because it wasn't at Wembley. I would love the opportunity to have what these players have. I would love the opportunity to win a Challenge Cup at Wembley. I think that would be the close on a pinnacle of a player's career.
It sounds absolutely fantastic. And I have to ask as well just about Hull FC. Obviously, very early in the season, it even seems like distant memory now of, you know, Lee Radford sort of being locked out of the dressing room and all the rest of it. But they seem to have really worked wonders within that squad. And it seems like it's managed to click. And Hull FC haven't been quite there over the last couple of seasons. But something seems to have clicked this year for them to become a real force in Super League.
Well, look. Let's be clear on one thing. There's no way in the world the players stage a coup of any sort in that game.
Yeah.
What it would have been is the players being embarrassed about their performance and saying to the coach and the coaching staff, "Mate, just give us a second here because this has nothing got to do with you. I mean, the apathetic performance we've just put in is nothing got to do with you. We don't want to tarnish you by involving you in this conversation. You're absolved from any guilt here. Let us deal with this." That's all that was. Now, it gets dressed up as the players walking them out. It was the players having that long, hard chat with themselves and saying, "What we've given now is not good enough." Listen, what Lee Radford and the story of Lee Radford at Hull FC is a lesson to everybody in sport, not just rugby league, in sport in general, that patience sometimes is what's needed. Because Lee Radford would have been drummed out the door and you could have written a thousand reasons why he should go very early on in his coaching career. Adam Pearson stuck with him. He said, and even when he stuck with him, it was considered, you know, the vote of confidence. But he backed him up then with money to sign players, and they're getting the rewards thus far. Having said that, it will amount to nothing unless they deliver a trophy.
Certainly very, very interesting to see. And I can't wait to be watching the Challenge Cup final this Saturday as well. Brian, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks a lot for joining us here on the Daytimes.
Danny, the pleasure's been all mine. Take care.
Elsewhere, of course, it was a big South Yorkshire derby as well. And, well, we had AD White on the phone. He used to play for Rotherham. He used to also play for Leeds United as well. I thought he was a lot older. He's only 24, believe it or not. You know, he's played for that many different clubs over the years. So we had him on Daytimes the other day, just previewing that South Yorkshire derby.
No problem at all.
It's a pleasure having you on. AD, you must be pleased with the great start to the season.
Yeah, definitely. It's fantastic. You know, we've had a good start to the season, 2 out of 4 wins, and you know we've got a big game on Saturday against Rotherham, and hopefully we can pick up another couple of points, which will, you know, really top off a great start to the season.
It certainly looks that way. I was watching Huddersfield against Barnsley, and what an absolutely cracking game that was. It didn't seem that it worked out for you lads in the end, and a bit of a heartbreak ending there, but still, you had a fantastic performance in the second half, and a lot of positives to take from that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, first half wasn't great by our standards, but second half we came out and gave it a good go, and we were disappointed not to get the win. It was a bit of a sucker punch last minute goal, but you know that happens in football. But like I say, there's a lot of positives, you know, to take out from the game. We gave them a good game and showed that we can compete at this level over the last 4 games, and you know I'm certain we'll have a good season.
AD, looking at last season and, you know, just how that campaign ended, incredible what happened. Do you feel that feel-good factor has been kept going into the Championship campaign?
Yeah, definitely. I don't think we fear any opposition. It's a very hard league, but we know we're very capable. We're a young team, not loads of experience in the Championship. But, you know, we're definitely sure we've got the ability and the mentality to compete at this level. And over the last 4 games, I think in all of them, not just the ones that we've won, I think we've shown that we've got what it takes to be a Championship team.
I mean, it very much seems that team spirit has really carried over from last season, Eddie.
Yeah, 100%, definitely. The spirit amongst the team and the fans, and I think the whole community really is together, and everyone's getting behind the team, which is fantastic.
We're just going to look ahead to Rotherham, a great South Yorkshire derby. There should be a cracking atmosphere. Looking forward to that game and the atmosphere that'll bring.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, with it being a local derby, I'm sure there'll be a buzzing atmosphere and a few extra fans down to the already masses that come to the games. You know, a little bit extra special for me with it being a previous club at, like Rotherham. You know, I was there for a little while last season, but I'm looking forward to the game and can't wait for it.
I was going to say there, you know, you had that association with Rotherham. What's it going to be like, you know, for yourself, obviously, when you face Leeds as well, when you know, you get to see familiar faces? What is that like for yourself?
It'll be okay. I mean, mentally, I'll treat it like any other game. But obviously, you know, you do see people you know and play against your friends and things like that. But once it gets to kickoff time, you know, you're just concentrated on the game ahead of you, and none of that really matters. But it is nice to, you know, see a few old faces and catch them after the game. But once it comes to kickoff time, it's business as usual.
It very much seems that way. And Eddie, I have to ask as well, does it feel like you're part of a bit of a Barnsley revival, part of a bit of a project over there at the moment? Because obviously everything that happened last season and that two fantastic wins over at Wembley, it feels like the story hasn't quite ended for Barnsley yet.
No, definitely. I'm sure we'll cement ourselves in the Championship. It was a fantastic sort of 6 to 7 months of since sort of the new year, really, at Barnsley, and you know, I'm sure we can continue that. Like I say, we've got the squad and the management team and all the staff, and you know, we're all together, and we're gonna make this a good go at the Championship. And like I say, I'm sure we can achieve staying up and even better, hopefully.
And I was going to say there about the targets and the aims, because, you know, for some fans, considering what happened last season, you know, some will be aiming for mid-table, maybe even high. But just how important is it that, you know, for now you keep the aims realistic?
Yeah, definitely. The main aim is survival, obviously. That's got to be the first on the board. But, you know, I think we realistically can achieve higher. You know, we've got a good team in Munsters and a good squad. And, you know, we can get higher, and that'll be our main aim, you know, to push up sort of mid-table. You never know but what happens in football, but survival is our first port of call. But I think, you know, we can achieve much more as well.
It just does seem like it is going to be exciting times for Barnsley, especially with such a young squad. It really is a sky's the limit sort of situation when you're around with players of that sort of age that are always gaining that experience.
Yeah, definitely. It's important. And, you know, we've got a few that have played Championship, but not that many. So for them to gain this experience, it's only going to better them and improve them. You know, we have got a young squad, but the talented players, and with the added experience, you know, who knows what we can achieve.
And just looking at the transfer deadline day, obviously coming up, and for Barnsley, the whole thing that players are coming in, it must be a good feeling, you know, to see that the money being invested and the talent going up.
Yeah, definitely. I think the club have gone the right way about, you know, buying players. They've bought young, hungry players. They've shown they've got the talent and capabilities of, you know, playing at this level. And they've added to sort of the already many, many talented players that we've got. But, you know, they've bought in some very good players, you know, and hopefully we can keep hold of one or two that have, you know, obviously shown interest in, clubs have been interested in, and we can build on that. And it'd be fantastic if, you know, we could for a couple of seasons keep the team together, and, you know, who knows what could be achieved.
Yeah, you're right there. Certainly it's exciting times over at Oakwell, and we'll all be keeping a close eye on what's happening over there. Eddie, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Daytimes.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Eddie White there speaking to us on Daytimes. We always love to have some big sports guests get involved. But if there's another thing that you really want to... you might not want to see it, quite frankly, because this causes divisions in offices up and down the country. It's Mrs. Brown's boys. And to add some flames to the fire, it got voted as the best comedy of the 21st century. That's not on, is it? It really isn't. Well, I didn't think that, but Andy and Tom did, so we had a good debate about it. Also, you know when you look at something sometimes and you think, well, that shouldn't be there. That's definitely Mrs. Brown's boys. It just doesn't get any worse than that. But one thing it depends on your value of transfers. It depends on the transfer market, really, if you like it or not. Some managers hate it, some managers love it. It depends from one to another. But there's some myths that we just all seem to go along with, and I spoke to Jack Cohen. He's a lawyer. That's been writing articles for The Guardian on this, and he dispelled some fantastic myths on it. Now, there are certain issues that sometimes divide an office and can really tear people apart, and this seems to have done it. So we're gonna have a group therapy session now to try and heal Twitter as well. I'm pleased to say I'm joined by the afternoon's Andy Lawson.
Good afternoon, Danny Parkinson.
Thanks for joining us, Andy. And Tom Feeney from the news team. And Tom, as also, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
I didn't mean to ignore that. But first off, we need to tell you the issue. Mrs. Brown's Boys has been voted the best British comedy of the 21st century. And this is something that you, Tom, agree with.
Yeah.
You totally agree with that title.
Fantastic.
That it is the best 21st century British comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, it's laugh a minute. It's brilliant. Every episode something happens. There's good, you know, there's heartwarming moments. There's lessons you learn from it. It is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And to me, a lot of people jump on the bandwagon and go, oh, it's no good. And when you actually say to them, have you watched it? They go, oh, no, I haven't, but I've heard. No, watch it. If you don't like it, I guarantee you, you'll watch it. You will laugh a few times. You'll think it's great.
I watched 10 minutes of it, and it was one of the worst things I've seen on television. It was just so boring. It was
unbelievable. It's not boring.
It is.
It is not boring. It is not.
All right, let's say it's not smart. Andy Lawson, where do you stand on this?
Danny, you're going to dislike me greatly on this. Mrs. Brown's Boys, the very first time it was going to be aired, they showed a trailer. Mm. And I laughed, and I laughed a lot. So I watched the first one, and I've not laughed so much in my life. I know it's not brilliant, but it makes me smile. And is that not what a sitcom is about, ultimately?
I know, it's supposed to make you laugh, all right, and comedy's objective at the end of the day, so I'll give you that. You can say that it's good. I think it's absolutely woeful, but let's have a look at some of the things that it's beaten.
I'll just say, watch there was a live version, properly done live, about a month, 6 weeks ago. I don't know if it's still on iPlayer. Watch it. Brilliant.
It's brilliant. Still going.
Absolutely brilliant that one.
Oh, but let's have a look at what it's beaten, because this is what's horrific. This is what really got to me.
And also on a technicality, can I just say, you're saying British comedy, it's half made by RTE in Ireland, and it's based in Dublin, even though it's filmed in Scotland, I think.
All gets a bit complicated with that.
Sorry, right? I'll remove that bit of technicality out of it.
I totally agree with you, because that's what I was going to say to Tom, without being to say, it's Irish, but it's actually made.
Yeah, it's a combo of the two. It's half funded either way, I think.
So I won't go into that without going into the ins and outs of how it's produced. But...
Sorry, I took you there, didn't I?
Let's have a look at what it's beaten, right? Number two is one of the greatest TV programmes that Britain has ever made. Don't get me wrong, the American version was better. That's another debate in itself, but The Office.
Oh!
Not a fan, Andy Lawson.
Bored. Boring. It was like, when it first came out, I liked it. I thought it was good. Now, I've moved on. I was 21 when I liked it first time. I'm not 21 anymore, by quite a long way, so I'm like, yeah.
But it only went for a few seasons, and it was
two,
there,
I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, two seasons, yeah, so...
No,
but he's all right, it's not got rewatchability, I'll give you that. The American version was better.
The original time, definitely when I watched it, yes, I enjoyed it. But do I want to watch the David Brent film now? Nah.
No, that's fair enough. Tom, but where do you stand on
that? Yeah, I like it. I wouldn't be like Andy and say that I wouldn't watch it again. I mean, I could watch it again quite
surely
easily.
It's bigger than Mrs. Brown's
Boys. No, but it's not better. It's not better, that's the reality.
It is, but that's objective. Well, I've got to move on to number four, because I've never heard of Count Arthur Strong.
I'll tell you this now.
It's not a number three, I can tell you that. It's all right, but it's not a number three.
Hang on, is this like Mrs. Brown's Boys, but worse, that I once watched?
Yes, it probably is. Yeah.
He's like isn't he like an old actor or something who toured the clubs back in like the 60s, but thinks he's a megastar? It's all right, but it's not the third best comedy ever made.
Because above that, he's got PK's Car Share.
Love it. Amazing.
If he never came on television again, I wouldn't be bothered. But it's fine.
Well, I cannot wait for the second series of it. I think it's amazing.
Another series.
I think so. I hope so.
Wow. Elsewhere, The IT Crowd.
Yes.
Now, this is one of the greatest comedies ever produced. And it's so British. That's what makes it great, because it is so British.
I'm going to stand back from this one. I've never seen it.
You've never seen it.
I know of it. I'm well aware of it, and I know like who's in it, but I've never actually seen it.
You have to watch this. I rewatch IT Crowd.
Yes.
Honestly, you can every episode, just brilliant. Honestly, brilliant.
It's only from start to finish. Everyone's I can rewatch them over and over again. It's absolutely superb.
I'll add it to the list.
Yes, definitely do, Andy Lawson. Definitely do. This will be one of those in the morning. We'll go, Andy, have you seen it? Have you seen it yet, Andy? Have you seen it? Got to go to number six. So it's my favourite comedy of all time. Political satire. It's absolutely brilliant. The Thick of It came sixth. Now, I don't know if everyone's watched this, to be honest. That's why I'm putting it down as sixth.
It's marvellous. It's great TV show.
It's very good, but it's still not better than Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Oh, no!
Now, come on, Feeney. Hang on.
That's awful.
And there are reasons why.
Why?
First one, the thick of it...
Explain yourself.
I mean, that's the thing. They're two different genres, aren't they? The thick of it, you know, it's good, and I do watch it, and I do laugh at it, but it's not laugh a minute, for a start. Mrs. Brown's Boys is a comedy, it's laugh a minute. You can watch Mrs. Brown's Boys, you know, at 5 a.m. in the morning, just when you've got in, where at whatever time, the thick of it...
It's a good night out, that one, isn't it?
Bailey, what have you been doing?
To me, the thick of it, you've got to watch it at, like, 8 p.m. That, you know, you can't watch it too late because it gets too complicated. You've got to watch it at certain times.
So you're saying that Mrs. Brown's Boy is better because you can't watch the thick of it at certain times because it's too complicated?
Yes. Okay. And I think a lot of people would agree with me.
There is a connection of the two of them, though, which is that the language in both of them would mean they'd have to be broadcast post 9 p.m. That's the one connection. Yep.
That is very, very true, and I love that. But I have to say, think of it one of my favourites of all time. A couple of people have got in touch on this one, and guess what they're saying? Kevin got in touch. Thanks for getting in touch, Kevin. It's a bit, even Mrs. Brown's Boy is really the best sitcom of the 21st century. He said, "Don't be ridiculous. It's a horrible show." And Adam, he went down your route, Andy. Is it the best British sitcom? He went, "It's Irish." It gets complicated, Andy. Adam, sorry, we won't go into that, but thanks for getting in touch, and I'm sure we'll have more fallout of this. Lads, thanks a lot for joining us here. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'd love to go through all 20, but there's so much there.
That's one for a podcast, isn't it, Dan?
It certainly is. We will do this very, very
soon. Thanks so much for having me on, Dan. I really appreciate it.
I mean, I read your article in The Guardian. It was fascinating because there's so many points in there where you look at that and you think a lot of these things are just a given, that these things happen all the time. But there are quite a few myths surrounding transfer windows and deadline days, really.
There are, yeah. You know, and thank you again for the kind words. You know, there are a few sort of lesser known facts about how the transfer window works, and I think this article was just a good opportunity to discuss them, you know, especially given that, you know, the transfer window is winding down. It seemed useful to sort of share, you know, what we've learned from working inside the industry to the general public.
Yeah, no, one of those things that I only learned not so long ago was on shirt sales. I mean, I always thought that if you went into a retailer, you bought a shirt, those proceeds would go to the club. It doesn't necessarily work like that.
No, it doesn't. Yeah, I think the short answer is that that's actually a myth. You know, while there are some exceptions, the industry standard for shirt deals sees the clubs receive an upfront payment plus around 10 to 15% of the shirt sale revenue. So you'll see 85 to 90% of the shirt sale revenue go to the manufacturers, so Nike, Adidas, Puma, New Balance, and the like. However, one of these exceptions is Manchester United's deal with Adidas, which sees the club earn £75 million per year, which is actually more than double that of any other Premier League club shirt deal this season. So no doubt, as a result of the huge upfront fee, they actually don't receive a cut of the shirt sales until a very, very large number is sold, in the millions. So Manchester United sold around 3 million shirts last season. And of course, you know, the likes of Paul Pogba, Zlatan, are going to help sell more. However, it's important to note that many of those fans were already planning to buy a shirt anyways. So even though you'll see the likes of maybe Pogba sell more shirts, I think many of those fans are just going to be choosing to buy a Pogba shirt over, say, you know, maybe another Wayne Rooney shirt or a Chris Smalling shirt. United's deal with Adidas has another 9 years to run. So pending any early termination clauses, if shirt sales continue to increase, then naturally so too will the value of Manchester United's future deals. But right now, Manchester United has a fixed fee of £75 million, pretty much regardless of the number of sales they see. So the better United does with regards to shirt sales, it's really Adidas that is benefiting. And I think it's important to note that compared to sport manufacturers like Nike and Adidas, football clubs are actually a very small business. To sort of put it in perspective, Adidas earns more in 6 months than Manchester United, which is one of the highest earning football clubs in the world, has earned in its 138-year history.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, it really is incredible. And Nike, they earn more in 2 months than every Premier League club earned last year combined. So these kit manufacturers, you know, they're smart, they know what they're doing, and to sort of put it out there that not only do these kit manufacturers pay this huge upfront fee, but then they also give all of the shirt sale money to the club, like, that doesn't make any business sense. Like, what's the benefit to Nike and Adidas? So the benefit to them is actually the shirt sale revenue.
Absolutely unbelievable. There's so many figures and facts in there that have totally blown my mind. But the what I also have to pick up on as well is he's on fax machines, because it was a big thing made about the De Gea deal, the fact that it was in, you know, a different font, for example, and it all sort of went a bit haywire. And it all seems a little bit hectic when it gets towards deadline day, and it's especially all rushing. But it's not necessarily down to faulty fax machines that some of these deals don't go through.
No. I'm not sure the fax machines have been used actually for quite a while, at least with regards to sort of getting the transfer paperwork in, if you will. FIFA has actually required all international transfers to be put through this online system called FIFA TMS, and that's been in place, you know, since 2010. So if you're familiar with a Google Doc, for example, it's very similar to that. However, every single bit of information you input has to match up with the input. So if you're the buying club, all the information that you input has to match up with the information that the selling club is inputting, and then it'll match. It's called FIFA TMS, the transfer matching system. And so all clubs actually have to designate employees as what they call TMS managers, and it's really their responsibility for ensuring that the transfers are processed correctly. And, you know, these big clubs like Manchester United and Real Madrid, they luckily have several employees who have been trained on the FIFA TMS system. However, because most of the training is done internally, technically it should be done at the FA level, but I think in practice we'll see it done club to club, and we can see sort of discrepancies between the skill level and the training competency of some of these clubs. And FIFA TMS actually readily admits that the level of training and experience varies quite a bit. But, I mean, it's an online system. It's been this way for years. And, I do not see fax machine issues holding up deals, in practice.
And another one I've got to pick up on as well is just about the role that agents play. We all know about football agents and the roles that they play. But what about sort of manager agents and those relationships that go around? How important is the relationship between not just the agents and the players, but the managers and just people involved in football generally?
Well, I mean, it is about relationships, right? So, I mean, if you are looking, if you're, say, a Middlesbrough with your manager, you know, Aitor Karanka, you know, he has all these contacts in Spain. You know, if there was a Italian manager, an English manager, a French manager, you know, maybe they wouldn't have the connections in Spain to go out, you know, and really target, you know, those Spanish players. So, I mean, you know, football is definitely, an industry built upon strong relationships, for sure.
And just another one on there as well is everything talks about transfer budgets. Now, I've noticed this a little bit myself because we deal quite a lot over here with Huddersfield and Bradford City and Leeds United. It actually tends to be on much more of a player-by-player basis. But when you look at the Nationals and they say, for example, Arsenal have £200 million to spend, that kind of a war chest, it always seems like these figures are never really, you know, that backed up to that exact figure. It seems that this is maybe something of a media invention, really, for the old war.
Yeah, net spend is not really something that big clubs take into account when calculating their quote-unquote transfer budget. In fact, every club in Europe's top eight leagues and the majority of the other European clubs do something called capitalizing and amortizing transfer fees. So that's just fancy accounting speak for on the books. The transfer fee is spread out over the length of the player's contract. So as an example, you know, if a club buys a player for £50 million and that player then signs a five-year deal, the club won't record that £50 million all at once this summer. Rather, that £50 million will be spread out as £10 million over the next 5 years. And so if you stick with that example, if that new £50 million player is earning £100,000 a week, we can see that he's costing $5.2 million a year in basic wages, $100,000 a week times 52 weeks in a year. So if we just look at the player amortization, which is $10 million a year, and the wages, $15.2 million a year, we can see that he's costing the club $5.2 million a year. We'll see that he's costing the club $15.2 million a year, and that's before factoring in the transfer levy, the signing on fee, any performance bonuses, the agent fees, and potentially a separate image rights deal. And that's how clubs look at player costs. You know, it's worth noting that transfer fees represent less than one-third of total player costs to clubs, which is why a figure like net spend actually tells you very little about club finances. So last season, for example, Premier League clubs spent just over £1 billion on transfers. This is the first time any league has ever spent £1 billion on transfers in a season. However, those Premier League clubs also spent over £2 billion in wages. So, you know, as we can see, transfer fees actually represent a much smaller amount of the total player costs and wages. And there are other costs involved as well. So the transfer levy and agent fees, for example, they add another £86 million to player costs. So if you just look at net spend, you're really discounting the majority of costs involved, you know, when clubs, you know, buy new players.
Jake, if anyone wants to find out more about this and find out things in a little bit more detail about how fascinating these stories can be, how can they actually look into this?
Well, you know, I'm actually a lawyer in the sports team at Mills and Reeve, and we just launched a project we created a fictional footballer, a young Brazilian player called Rivaldo, and we're actually going to follow his entire career, and we're going to discuss all the issues, you know, that he'll face. And we just launched the website. It's at www.rivaldo.com. And, yeah, please do check it out. You know, it should be a fun, engaging, and accessible way to sort of learn more about how the football industry actually works.
Wow, he's totally unbelievable. There's so much I didn't know about transfer markets that I thought I knew before. Jake, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for joining us here on Radio Yorkshire.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dan. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys.
Well, that's all we've got time for this time around. Thanks a lot for joining us. We had loads of great stuff this week, so make sure you get involved. audiobeam.com/Radio Yorkshire if you want to listen to any other interviews that we had throughout the week. And as always, thanks a lot for listening.